Welcome to the Global Research News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman, brought to you by globalresearch.ca. And I'm delighted to have Larry Everest back on the program. It's always interesting when Larry comes on. He has a wealth of experience firsthand, and certainly on the topic we'll spend a lot of time talking about today. For those who don't know Larry, he's a correspondent for Revolution Newspaper. Website is revcom.us. He's also reported from Iran. We certainly will talk about that this morning. Iraq and Palestine, to provide vital information on the region. And he has a book that was written, a few years ago now, but it's still a winner. I remember when I read it, I knew nothing about Larry, but I certainly knew about him after reading his book. It's called Oil, Power, and Empire, Iraq and the U.S. Global Agenda. Larry, it's great having you back on again.
Thanks, Steve. Good to be with you.
Oh, it's terrific. There's never a lack of things to talk about. I mean, we could do it 24 hours a day, you name it, Christmas, New Year's. There's so much that's disturbing, and you've got a lot of knowledge on it. Right now, of course, Iran is front and center. And you were there, as you told me, in 1979, the revolution in 1980. Well, it looks like we're back in that mode again, with no idea yet how things will turn out. What are your thoughts on what's going on?
Well, first of all, seeing the videos from Iran does harken back to the time I was there. I was there in the summer of 89. This was shortly after the overthrow of the Shah. But when
79, you mean?
79, yeah. 1979, shortly after the overthrow of the Shah, but when before the Islamic Republic had been really consolidated and when, you know, hundreds of thousands of people were still protesting for many different viewpoints. And so when I saw the pictures, this time, around this current struggle, I was very inspired to see so many people fighting so courageously against injustice and oppression, and B, seeing the Basjai and the Revolutionary Guards and the various elements of the state reminded me of the thugs that I saw, and there's no other way to put it. I was in a demonstration in 1979 in Iran after the shutting down of the newspaper Ayendagan. It was a paper something like The Nation, a liberal democratic kind of a thing, and it was shut down by the regime in August. And there was probably 100,000, 150,000 of us, and I marched in this demonstration, and we were just viciously attacked with rocks, and some guy grabbed me and he had a big length of pipe, and he said, "Are you an American?" And he was ready to bash my head in, and "No, I'm Canadian." So I'm up with Global Research. I'm up there where you guys are.
No, Global Research didn't exist in 79.
Yeah, but Fran... But, people were killed in that, and it was ugly, and that's the same kind of reactionary brutality that's going on now, coming from the Islamic Republic. And I just think it's a jolt and an inspiration and really a challenge to people around the world. Let's have the courage of the Iranian people.
Larry, we need to take a break. I think there's a lot more going on than that. And 79 was not a good time to be an American in Tehran, for sure. But we'll be right back.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome back to the News Hour. On with Larry Everest talking about Iran. Larry, as you well know, and I as well, and I've written about it, the same kind of thuggishness that you saw and that certainly is going on now to some degree at least, also goes on in many countries, including right here in U.S. cities. And certainly, you remember the ones against global justice protesters. That's the term that I prefer as opposed to anti-globalization. But most recently, during last summer's Democrat and Republican conventions, when what do you call them? Security force thugs on the street, including infiltrators, clubbing people, arresting them, doing all kinds of horrible stuff. You remember that very well.
Oh,
so
yeah.
It goes on here, too.
I was in Denver. Yeah, I was in Denver at the Democratic National Police State, I called it.
Oh, exactly. Exactly.
Well, I mean, you're pointing to an important thing. This is a complex, I mean, first of all, you know, there are the desires of the Iranian people, and even that's not one monolithic block. There are different impulses, inclinations, political views within those that mass of millions, literally, who've been protesting. Then we've got the struggle within the Iranian establishment between Ahmadinejad and Khamenei on the one side, if the people that they're representing or the faction they're representing, and then the Mousavis and Rafsanjanis, neither one of which is really a force for liberation. These are fights within the context of an Islamic Republic over how to best rule Iran, how to revive its economy, how to ward off threats around the region. And then, as you're pointing to, we have the U.S. imperialists getting involved in this. I have to say, Steve, and here's that in looking at the media coverage, you know, CNN has been having this on just 24/7, and I'm thinking, you know, and I'm obviously, I like hearing the news and seeing all this, but then I think, gee, what happened when a pro-U.S. government massacred 20,000 Tamils in Sri Lanka? Were we getting, I mean, massacred 20,000 people? Were we getting video from that? Were we getting pictures from that to show the world? No, because the United States, it was fine with the U.S. Or how about when the Shah was in power? And on a Friday in September, 5,000 to 10,000 people were shot down. Now, the U.S. media had full access to Iran at that point. Did we see endless hours, even accounting for the changes in the media since then? Did we see endless hours of film footage on that? No, we didn't, nor do we see footage of many struggles that are directed against the United States. Do we see extensive reporting from Palestine? Why isn't the situation in Gaza, which is still completely intolerable for the masses of people, why aren't we seeing 24-hour coverage of the horrors the Palestinian people are facing?
Well, that's exactly true, Larry, and these topics obsess me just the way they do you. Sri Lanka is interesting because I don't think there was a single report in the media about the mass slaughter that went on there with U.S. support, with U.S. weapons, probably with U.S. advisors on the ground directing the government on how to mass murder its own people, and the U.S. media don't even blink an eye about it.
Right. No, it's true. I mean, what's interesting, you know, about the situation in Iran is that I think the thrust of the, the immediate cause of the protest was the election, which many people consider was stolen. But, and we can talk about that, the pros and cons of that. But I think there's also a deep anger and hatred of a lot of what the Islamic Republic has done. This is an extremely repressive society, particularly for women. Women are forced to wear the veil. They have vice squads that go around and can beat women for not wearing the veil. Women can be stoned and have been stoned for supposedly committing adultery. Women have half the legal rights that men do. Men can immediately divorce. Women lose in custody battles over children and wealth. Women have women's testimony is worth half what a man's is. So this is a regime that is based on reimposing extremely reactionary and feudalistic social relations. Now, of course, Iran is complicated because no matter what the Ayatollahs seek to impose, there's also the demands of production and the global market. And so you've got the irony that there's enormous tension between these Islamic norms and the fact that the majority of women in Iran are, the majority of college students in Iran are women, and that there's, you know, women are in many different professions, partly of necessity because of the death of the Iran-Iraq war. So you've got a complicated society, but I think that the thrust of what people are fighting against is that sort of that suffocation, the repression of artistic and political dissent, and also the impoverishment. There's huge unemployment in Iran and a lot of economic suffering.
Of course, some of their economic troubles, really, I guess, two-pronged, Larry. Certainly, the global economic crisis that's affecting every country on the globe. No country is immune to what's going on. But at the same time, the U.S.-led sanctions, unfair sanctions imposed on Iran because it wants to maintain its own sovereignty and run its own affairs, you know, good, bad, or otherwise, no country has the right to interfere in the internal affairs of another country. But we do it across the planet.
Well, that's really important because Obama, you know, look, we're dealing with two outmoded and reactionary social forces here, neither one of which offers a future for the planet. One is global imperialism, capitalism, imperialism. And, of course, this is the force that has by far the greatest influence in the planet and does by far the greatest damage. And on the other hand, we have Islamic fundamentalism, which, again, provides nothing for the masses of people. And, again, I saw this close up in Iran in 1979. I was back again during the hostage crisis in 1980. But in terms of the United States, and it is important to focus on that because I think a lot of people are thinking to themselves, gee, I'm sure glad we have Obama because he is being so much more reasonable than Bush would have been. But Obama is simply maneuvering to try to, you know, get the best way to weaken or overthrow the Islamic regime and more directly impose U.S. domination. I mean, in Cairo, Obama ridiculed the notion that the U.S. was an empire. And yet, look at what it's done in Iran. Many people know about the 1953 coup d'etat by the CIA that overthrew Mossadegh, an elected leader who was trying to nationalize Iranian petroleum, and his replacement by the Shah of Iran, a brutal torturer and dictator under whom the Iranian people suffered for 25 years. Or we can take the U.S.'s role after the revolution. What happened within a year of the revolution? In 1980, the U.S. encouraged Iraq to invade Iran in hopes of weakening or overthrowing the Khomeini regime, and this led to an eight-year ground slog in which a million people were killed and in which the U.S. facilitated Iraqi use of chemical weapons against Iran. And, of course, now this is something I've detailed in my book. It's also I have a series in Revolution, revcom.us, as you mentioned, on the whole history of U.S. intervention in Iran. So people can look at that or go to my website, LarryEverest.com. And it's interesting because this, the gassing, the use of chemical weapons, and the absolute silence or really meaningful, absolute refusal to do anything meaningful against Saddam's use of chemical weapons by the international community was one of the things that pushed Iran to decide it needed a nuclear program, which, by the way, was begun under the Shah, and it was really halted initially under Khomeini, but then due to the use of gas in the Iran-Iraq war, this was the impetus for it. And we also have to remember that the issue of an attack on Iran by the U.S. or Israel has not been taken off the table. This is looming in the background still, and I think is one of the causes of the arguments within the Islamic Republic.
It's very possible that it could happen, Larry. I honestly don't believe it will, but you never know. There are a lot of crazies around, and you can't predict what they might do. But we have to take another break. Let's do that, and we'll come right back.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to the News Hour. On with Larry Everest, talking about Iran. Larry, there's no question you and I stand for the same things. Oh, our approaches might be slightly different, but we believe in equity, justice, freedom, democracy for everybody. Neither a repressive type of capitalist system like we have. We're an elite few percent, really an elite 1% on top, get the great majority of the benefits, and they get them at the expense of the huge majority beneath them. And, of course, it's been going on so horrifically, especially in recent years and especially over the past couple of years. And on the other extreme, any society on the other extreme that denies rights to its people, whether it's a theocracy in countries like Iran, and Iran is really a picnic, Larry, as you know, compared to places like Saudi Arabia, where a couple of years ago, and I'll let you pick it up from here, a couple of years ago I discovered that during prayer time, they have deployed on the streets whipping police. If anybody is found on the streets during prayer time, they're whipped. Now, I must admit, the first thought that came to me was, who whips the whippers? Because they're on the streets and they should be praying.
Yeah.
But you take over.
No, I had the same thought. I mean, you know, the hypocrisy of the U.S. is without end. You know, they're condemning Iran's election, and I for one, think it should be condemned and exposed. I mean, I do think, however, I think there's certainly evidence that I know you and I may have a somewhat different take on this. I certainly think there's evidence that the Iranian vote was tampered with. I mean, I don't have conclusive proof of that. I don't think anyone does. But and you know, the Iranian election, as elections here are really an exercise by the ruling class. Remember, the candidates in this country are handpicked. The candidates in Iran were handpicked, and literally hundreds eliminated. They're an exercise in modulating battles within the ruling class, as well as gaining the legitimacy of those who are ruled over. In other words, when you go in and vote, or here or in Iran, you're putting a stamp of legitimacy on the existing government. But even having said all that, it is This is one of the things that struck me is you never see coverage in the media of, well, what's the political situation like for the masses in Egypt or Jordan or, as you're pointing to, Saudi Arabia? I mean, there's in Jordan and in Egypt, there's no Saudi Arabia, there's no sort of election. In fact, I just read an article that the election for some legislative body that I don't think has much of any power anyway has been put off for 2 years in Saudi Arabia. This is just a small mention in the New York Times. And then we've, you know, during the run-up to the election, we saw massive crowds in Iran for both the candidates. But I was thinking to myself, you know, when do you see massive crowds in Egypt, Saudi Arabia, or Jordan? You never do, because they'd be gunned down. So, again, the hypocrisy of all this is just astonishing.
Well, there's no question about that, and you could go right through most of the countries in the Middle East, Larry. But the only places that have elections even close to legitimate would be Lebanon, the Palestinian election that elected Hamas, democratically elected government, and because they were democratically elected, we put them on our terrorist list. So
well,
it looks like Washington's definition of a terrorist is a democratically elected government that they don't approve of.
I think
we'd also agree this fraud, there's some fraud in all elections, and Exhibit A would be the kind that we hold, as we both know, two stolen ones for sure in 2000-2004, without a hint in the media that something was really amiss.
Right.
I honestly think that Ahmadinejad won. I think most important, Larry, is Washington wanted him to win. Israel wanted him to win. In an article I wrote, I quoted the head of Mossad, who said this. They needed a guy like Ahmadinejad to win to be able to beat up on him. If somebody portrayed as moderate one, they said, my God, there'd be a crisis. What are we going to do? We'd have to figure out a way to dirty this guy up.
Well, I think I'm not sure. I mean, I think there are probably different angles of this. I mean, certainly I've seen argument that some wanted Ahmadinejad to win because he could deliver the conservatives or hardliners, whatever you might call them, into an agreement with the U.S. You know, I think there's certainly the demonization aspect of it, but I think that Obama's strategy is to really try to weaken, to allow these protests to go forward without, you know, without saying anything that might discredit them, in hopes of weakening the Islamic Republic and forcing it to accept U.S. terms. And then his talk about negotiating. Then if they do feel the need for a military attack.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back to the News Hour. On with Larry Evers. We're talking about Iran. Larry, I've written a little bit about color revolutions. That term is certainly getting around now in the mainstream. A little bit, I guess, Iran's being called a green revolution. Non-really thuggish U.S.-instigated coups like the CIA did against Iran in 53, 79 is another story. We can go into it another time. But the CIA was pretty thuggish in ousting rulers, unacceptable to Washington rulers in the past. But high-tech stuff took over after the technologies were available beginning in the mid-1990s. And the first victim was Slobodan Milosevic in Serbia. He survived the Balkan Wars of the 90s, the 78-day horrendous NATO-U.S. bombing in the spring of 1999, and street protests against him. He survived all of that. So high-tech techniques were really unleashed against him, led by the U.S. ambassador to Belgrade. He was ousted. The two best analogies to Iran right now were Georgia in 2002, I think, and Ukraine 2004, early 2005. Claims of fraudulent elections, they were phony claims, but enough to get the Ukraine one annulled by the Supreme Court, and both of them to be rerun, so the Washington favorite won the second time, where that person did not win the first time. Well, I think that's the scheme this time, to get another election, and now the public is so revved up that maybe the loser in the first election, and I really believe Mousavi lost, and Ahmadinejad won. But in a rerun, it's very possible that angry people would vote him in and Ahmadinejad out. So this is the least bloody way to get rid of a regime you don't like. High-tech magic creating all of this kind of stuff.
Well, I mean, there's no doubt that the U.S. is intervening in the internal affairs of Iran. I mean, Bush authorized $400 million for covert operations in Iran, something that Obama hasn't repudiated or stopped. Now, I don't think that events in Iran are mainly being determined by the United States at this point. Certainly, the United States has been trying to have an influence, has been trying to do some things to encourage the anti-regime forces and struggles, but, you know, not a great deal. I mean, you know, Khatami, the previous prime minister, previous president, offered to make a deal with the United States in 2003 and was just rebuffed. At that point, Bush wanted the overthrow of the regime and didn't want either faction of it. So, I mean, there's no doubt that the United States is intervening. But I do have to say, I mean, there's some interesting material from the Communist Party of Iran, Marxist, Leninist, Maoist, that is up on the website at revcom.us, and it, you know, these are reports directly from the street, from people who are protesting, from different political trends in Iran. They come from the World to Win News Service, and they make the point that the in past elections, the results were announced regionally. This time, they were announced in waves. Each wave had the same percentage as the one before, even though this would not be something one would expect as different regions came in. Results were being announced of 40 million votes, the majority of which were not computer tallied, is my understanding, within 3 hours. Some of the candidates got, you know, some areas there were more than 100% turnout, other areas some of the candidates finished with very, very few votes, even in their own cities where one would expect them to win. So I do think that there's, as I said, I think there's evidence of fraud, and just mainly, but I think the main thing that's driving the protest is just anger and outrage at the nature of the Islamic Republic and the continuation of Ahmadinejad. And I think one thing I'd like to get into a little bit, and I don't know when our next break's coming, so I'm not sure.
About 10 minutes.
This is to be continued. But look, Iran poses very sharply. They had a U.S.-backed regime under the Shah. They've had U.S. imperialist domination. It's a nightmare. Then there was a revolution. It was a real revolution. The forces I like did not lead it. it brought in Islamic fundamentalism. That's been proven to be a horror. So what this poses very, very sharply is the need for another way for humanity, because right now the U.S. is taking advantage of the fact these outmodeds reinforce each other. The U.S. takes advantage of the depredations of Islamists in order to say, look, U.S. style and U.S.-backed democracy, that's your better choice. And the Islamists point to the history of the United States and what it's doing in Palestine and so on and say, no, Islam is the better choice. And neither one of them are. I mean, look at these green revolutions you mentioned in Georgia and Ukraine. They haven't brought liberation to the people of those countries. I mean, Ukraine is at this point is a complete economic basket case, and enormous suffering is going on because they're very much hooked into the global capitalist market. And as you were pointing out, you know, we've had all the collapse of the Soviet Union and the marketization of the world, and now we've got the biggest financial and economic crisis in decades since the Great Depression, and literally millions more people will starve to death, and tens of millions more will suffer because of that. So all of this points to the need for an alternative to capitalism, imperialism, or Islamic fundamentalism. And I think that, and I want to talk about that in a minute, but I think one thing that's important to know is when this genie of mass struggle and heroic sacrifice gets out of the bottle, when millions of people come into political life, this can evolve. I know right now many people there are wearing green and they're saying Mousavi, or they're saying, you know, I want my vote counted, but they're also saying death to the dictator and down with a dictatorship and other slogans. So these things can evolve, particularly if they're organized forces with a genuinely revolutionary program that can take this in a whole different direction.
Well, there's no question, Larry, and I think people everywhere are hungering for real freedom that so few anywhere have. I must say to you, we'll get evidence when this thing passes and we have some perspective, but there's a lot of evidence that the color revolutions in Georgia and in Ukraine earlier this decade were U.S. instigated. The protests with many tens of thousands of people on the street were staged. There were protesters, thousands of protesters, using millions of dollars from the National Endowment of Democracy, maybe CIA dollars, other front groups fronting for the U.S. imperial system, paying off people to get in the streets and making these claims about fraud and so on to get the people angry. And it worked. I mean, this was a theatrical production to oust governments that the U.S. did not support, to get ones installed that the U.S. did support. And the two regimes in Ukraine and in Georgia, not only are they being crushed by neoliberal policies, but you've got thuggish rulers, especially the guy in Georgia, Saakashvili. He's nothing but a U.S. stooge, but this guy Yushchenko in Ukraine, there's evidence that since he took office, he's stolen he and his cronies have stolen around $1 billion, and the people are suffering terribly. So this is the fate that Iranians will have if there's a U.S. imperial regime installed, and they have that to fear very much with what's going on.
Well, I mean, I wouldn't disagree on the Orange Revolutions. I don't think that, and I certainly don't disagree that if some sort of a pro-U.S. regime is put in place in Iran, the results wouldn't be the same. I don't think at this moment we're really in that. I wouldn't make a precise comparison between Ukraine and Georgia on one hand and Iran on the other. I simply don't think that the U.S. has that kind of control in Iran, and I think that that's one of the reasons they find the Islamic Republic intolerable and are trying to curb it. But in terms of this alternative to capitalism and alternative to Islamic fundamentalism, I do think this is one reason I'm a big proponent of Bob Avakian's re-envisioned socialism and communism, because I think what he's done, and, you know, again, you can read this, get all this information at Revolution, but basically after the collapse of the Soviet Union, the verdict was that communism's a huge failure, a nightmare, blah, blah, blah. And, of course, this was something that's been systematically lied about by the imperialists. So there was a huge job to take a look at this first wave of revolutions. What was good about these revolutions? What were bad things that happened? What were problems? Everything that the capitalists said wasn't untrue in the sense they were pointing to some real problems. So how do you really sum up this whole historical experience, and what lessons do you draw? And basically he has drawn the lesson that you still have to have the wealth, knowledge, and technology of this world wielded for the benefit of humanity, not for the pursuit of profit. That's the core communist idea, if you will, you know, that this enormous wealth and potential has to be used to serve humanity and to overcome these differences of nation, class, race, and so on. So he's arguing for that core mission and upholding these revolutions in terms of having made important strides to it, but at the same time pointing out serious errors and shortcomings and re-envisioning this project. Now, I'm not going to go on at length now because that isn't our topic this morning, but I do want to point that out as something that I'd encourage people to look at, because I do think that this is the direction, and they have a party in Iran that goes in this kind of a direction, and I just think that that's really something we desperately need now, because otherwise what choices do we have between these outmoded social forces?
Well, the thing that worries me, Larry, is if we don't go in the direction that you're discussing, the alternative may be we'll end up destroying ourselves. I mean, we're doing it by absolutely destroying the environment. I mean, we're just the chemicals alone that we pump into it. I mean, we're going to reach a point where nothing will grow in the ground that is an absolutely toxic poison, not fit to eat. Even organic foods, my God, I mean, the contamination spreads everywhere. And, of course, the big immediate threat is the idea of some kind of a catastrophic war where U.S. policy is a nuclear first strike against any nation we decide on our own with no evidence is a threat to our national security. So I guess Iran is a threat to our national security because it exists, not because it's a threat to attack anybody. By the way, another big issue on Iran, a big, big issue on Iran, this is the Israeli equation in this. Iran is the only rival it has in the Middle East, and Israel wants to be the Middle East hegemon, just the way we want to be the global hegemon. So Iran is the rival. You've got to get rid of Iran to give Israel an open field. It's not because Iran is a threat to Israel. Iran is a threat to nobody, no other country. But we have to say Iran is a threat. So we create this straw man and get people scared about some kind of a nuclear program. There's no evidence that they're building a bomb. Well, I mean, this is ugly stuff, so we need to dispel this. But that's behind what's going on also.
Well, I mean, you know, I think the Israel looms large. I mean, I think that But let me just begin with your point on the environment. I totally agree with you on that point, and it just astonishes me. How can people think that you can resolve a global issue of this magnitude? The environment goes beyond any particular locality. It goes beyond any particular company. It goes beyond any particular group of people. It involves the whole planet. How can you solve that problem on the basis of a social and economic system that pits individuals against each other in competition, or actually at this point in history, big group, big blocks of capital against each other in a life and death, expand or die kind of struggle, and pits nations against each other in this same kind of global competition? With that kind of a social system, how can you possibly solve a global issue that's going to take enormous cooperation, enormous coordination, a revolutionizing of the way we produce goods and services today, and really a revolutionizing of how people think and think about the world, think about their responsibility to society, and so on. None of this. I mean, it, to me, it's just absurd to think that what you're going to screw in an environmentally friendly light bulb and drive a hybrid, and that's going to do much of anything for this. And it just strikes me as absurd to think that a system based on private property and competition is going to be able to do anything to resolve this.
Certainly the system that we have, Larry, it is so hugely destructive. It just chews up people like...
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to the News Hour, final segment with Larry Everest. Oh, this is such a big topic, Larry, and of course, there are so many, and there's never enough time to talk about it all, and you turn on your TV set, and you and I both are absolutely appalled at the kind of absolute crap they're putting out 24 hours a day. I think it's the worst that I've seen, and I have to monitor a little bit because of what I do. I think it's the worst since the run-up and in the early days of the Iraq War. They're in full battle mode to oust the Iranian government, and they just don't give a damn how many lies they have to tell to do it, and all the rest. Well, you see it, I see it. There's so much more I wanted to say about it, including this face of what's going on. This young girl Nita, who I think was pre-selected to die because she was young, beautiful. She reminds me of the Kuwaiti ambassador back in 1990. You remember that?
Right,
posing as a teary-eyed
right.
a girl telling lies about Saddam,
right,
dumping
right.
babies out of incubators. It was all a big PR stunt.
Right. Well, in this, I have to disagree. I mean, I feel like, yes, she probably has become, look, there are reports that 100, and these aren't just from the U.S. media. I mean, this is also from within Iran, that perhaps up to 150 people have been killed. I mean, I'm sure she become a symbol because, and she does symbolize the fact that many women are taking part in this, that women have been an important force in this. Now, certainly the U.S. is trying to take advantage of the very courageous struggle of the Iranian people and direct it in a way that's favorable to their interests, which are weakening and perhaps overthrowing the government. But I don't think we should lose sight of the fact that, I mean, I'm very inspired by this because people, I think the lesson here is that uprisings of the people can erupt without warning. And millions of people who've been passive and quiet and not doing much can suddenly be thrust into political life. And of course, I'm not saying there's a revolutionary crisis in Iran. There isn't. but it certainly points to how these things can jump off and evolve and should be a challenge to others around the world, particularly in this country, who are way too silent and passive in the face of the crimes, as you're pointing out, that this government is doing. I mean, I think that the U.S. and Israel, they do see Iran as a threat, but not for the reasons that they're saying, not because Iran is planning to wipe Israel off the map or start a nuclear war or even has a nuclear weapon. But as we has been assessed in a very interesting paper, again, on the Revolution website called An Assessment of the Momentum Toward War. And I'd also encourage people to read the article this week on Revolution, Response to Election Fraud Reveals Deep Schisms and Broad Hatred Uprising in Iran. That's on these events, and you can get that at revcom.us. And it goes into some of the complexities of this that we've been talking about, the splits in the Iranian ruling class, what Obama's strategy is, and the potential for something different to come out of this, and points to this assessment of why it is that the U.S. and Israel are so concerned about Iran and directing so much focus on it, including, again, I don't think war is something on the immediate horizon, but I really think it's something we have to pay very close attention to.
Larry, I'm going to cut you off because they'll break away to the next program. I think we'd also agree that in the weeks ahead, we'll get more evidence, we'll know more, and it's amazing how at that time...